Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
Are you one of the 5.8 million people who are invisible to the financial system? And what does it mean if you are? Child benefits, why thousands of high earners are getting a refund from HMRC, and why Lord Lee, FT Money's infamous buy and hold investor, is selling some of his shares. Welcome to the FT Money Show, the FT's weekly podcast on personal finance and investing. I'm Lucy Warwick-Ching, the FT Money's digital editor, and I'll be giving you this week's money news. Millions of people in Britain are virtually invisible to the financial system because there's not enough information available about their financial track record. New research from Experian out today reveals the extent to which these invisibles, also known in the industry as thin files or no files, can find themselves excluded from mainstream finance or charged a much higher rate for borrowing. James Jones, Head of Consumer Affairs at Experian, is with us in the studio to talk us through the data. But first, I want to play a clip from Jack Monroe, the British food writer, journalist and campaigner, who rose to fame with her blog, A Girl Called Jack. Due to a lack of information on her file, she found herself unable to borrow even £50, and her only options were high-interest lenders or pawning her goods for cash.
Because I had such a thin credit file, there was no history of me borrowing money or repaying it. I was unable to access even the simplest of borrowing.
Is Jack's experience typical of the problems experienced by these so-called invisibles?
It is. We've revealed this week that, as you said, 5.8 million people are virtually invisible to the financial system. This means that they've got little or no financial track record on which to be assessed. And we all know that having a decent credit rating is so important these days. It gives you access to a range of products and services, and also helps you get the best deal. So, you know, pay less. So, of course, anyone with a limited or non-existent financial history is really going to struggle.
And so tell me a bit about why you carried out the research.
Well, we're passionate about tackling financial exclusion, and this can be a factor. So, as I said, if you have little or no credit history, then it can be very difficult to access affordable credit. It can really limit your choice. So we want to help people be aware of the situation, be aware of things they might be able to do to address the problem, and also raise the issue, I think, to government and policymakers, because there may be other things that we can do to try and help.
And what section of society is affected? Is it really just Britain's poorest?
It actually affects quite a wide range of people. I mean, certainly people on lower incomes in rented accommodation who, you know, typically pay for things by cash can find themselves off the credit rating radar, if you like. But there are other people as well, older people maybe who've paid off the mortgage and don't have a need for credit. Young people who maybe haven't had the opportunity to build up much of a credit history yet. And also people moving to or back to the UK from overseas, maybe to live, work or study. Again, haven't had much opportunity to build up that all-important financial track record.
And so what can people do about this?
I think one of the key things is raising awareness, which is why we're making this announcement this week. And there are things people can do. It's quick and easy these days to check your credit report and your credit score. These are free now. And if you do that, you might spot if you fit into this invisibles category. And then you can get advice from our website on the things you might be able to do to actually start to strengthen your financial track record, such as getting regular household bills in your name and paying them monthly by direct debit, things like monthly phone contracts rather than pay as you go. And also, if you're a tenant, then we're working hard to help make rent count.
And should the industry be doing something about this? Sounds like you're doing something already, but is there, you know, a need for something else to be being done?
Well, I think awareness is absolutely vital. So I think as an industry, we need to join together to help make sure people are aware that this can be a problem. And also, it is something that, you know, potentially can be fixed. There are things, as we discussed, that people can do themselves. But I think as an industry, we need to make sure that the credit rating system, you know, remains fit for purpose and actually takes account of changing demographics, changing consumer behaviour. So, you know, we're very much aware of generation rent, and the number of tenants is forecast to, you know, increase significantly in the next 10, 20 years. So, I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're working hard to bring rank payments into people's credit reports to try to give everyone the opportunity to build that all-important track record.
Thanks very much there to James Jones from Experian. If you want to learn more about Britain's invisibles, I've written a feature explaining in more detail, which you can read online at ft.com/money. Child benefit is the thorn in most high earners' sides. Since 2013, couples where one partner earns more than £60,000, the couple can still claim it, worth about £1,000 per child. But they have to pay it all back in the form of extra income tax. So in effect, the benefit is cancelled out. But if that wasn't complicated enough, those earning above £50,000 and in receipt of the child benefit are charged tax in increments up to £60,000. These parents have to complete a tax return to pay back the tax they owe or opt out of receiving the benefit altogether. But unsurprisingly, given how complicated it is, many parents got it wrong and were fined. But the good news is that HMRC is now paying back those fines. Joining us now to explain how HMRC got into this muddle is Becky O'Connor in her new role as Personal Finance Specialist at Royal London. Becky, thanks for coming in. Can you enlighten us? Why are HMRC paying back these fines? It's not like them to give money back to taxpayers, so why now?
You're quite right. It's very unlike them. Normally, they apply the ignorance is no defence rule as a blanket thing. However, in this case, it was so complicated, they've sort of seen fit to backtrack, but only in very specific cases. So in those cases where someone received child benefit before 2013, so before this new charge, the high income child benefit charge was introduced, and then the income of one earner rose to more than 50,000 after that charge was introduced, the revenue sees that there is a chance that those individuals in particular missed all the communications, missed all the marketing, would have had no idea that receiving child benefit that they already had was going to incur this new charge. Importantly, the fines, the refund of the fines won't apply if you applied for child benefit after that date, because the revenue thinks that when you signed up, you should probably have seen that little bit about 50,000 plus being eligible for this charge.
Wow, so it gets even more complicated.
Yes.
So how much should people hope to get?
Well, this is the less exciting bit. So the revenue is actually refunding the failure to notify penalty fines that are issued between 2013 and 2016. These were £100 each. That is what most people would have had. So if you were charged the penalty fine for 3 years, the most you will get is £300.
So not a lot, but better than nothing.
Better than nothing.
And what has HMRC said about it?
It said, to quote, "It's listening to customers and stakeholders and reviewing our approach to high income child benefit charge to ensure we're treating everyone fairly. Customers don't need to ask for a penalty refund or contact HMRC. We'll issue the refunds, where due over the next 6 months."
That was my other question. I was going to say, how do people get their money back? So they just wait.
Just wait. So the revenue, in its wisdom, will have identified you if you are eligible for the refund. So you don't need to do anything. If you think after 6 months that you should have had a refund and the revenue's missed you, it's possible, then do get in touch directly.
OK, and is there anything else that higher earning parents should be aware of in relation to the child benefits?
Yes, absolutely. So you may think that if you earn over 50,000, certainly over 60,000, why bother with claiming the child benefit at all? And the reason to at least engage with it and fill out the form is that it is the way the revenue identifies who might be eligible for national insurance credits. So if national insurance credits are there to ensure that if somebody who isn't working wants a state pension, they can still get one. These credits, a national insurance credit for 1 year fills in the gap in a working life. So if there's a stay-at-home parent and there's a one earner earning over 60,000, fill out the form, just tick the box that says we don't want to claim child benefit, we're just filling out the form, and that will ensure that that stay-at-home parent still receives the national insurance credits. And they don't then miss out on thousands of pounds in retirement.
Well, that's incredibly useful to know. Thanks very much. That was Becky O'Connor of Royal London. And you could read more about this online at ft.com/money. Finally, are you wary of buying and selling stocks too often? Do you think investing in a good stock and patiently holding it through periods of uncertainty and volatility is the route to investment success? If the answer is yes, then you're not alone. FT Money's columnist John Lee, Lord Lee, has written for many years for the FT about his winning buy and hold strategy, but his latest column shows him taking a slightly different stance. Lord Lee is here to tell us what he's been doing. Welcome. It's great to have you on the show. You have a loyal following among FT readers. Tell us why you've been selling your stocks.
Thank you. Hello. Well, let me say right at the outset, I've not changed my fundamental strategy. But nevertheless, a combination of family circumstances, endeavouring or the need to help daughters with housing upgrades, really necessitated bringing out some money from my portfolio. And also, I mean, we are obviously entering in a period of considerable volatility. This was really pre-budget. When I made a few sales, we obviously have got the uncertainty of Brexit. You know, there's a possibility of rises in interest rates. You've got your China-US trade situation. So it is a tricky period. And when you're sitting on some very substantial profits, as I've been fortunate to do, and some of the yields have drifted down to very, very low figures, which aren't defensive in any sense. And you're conscious also that because people also have made big profits, it only needs, particularly with some of the small cap stocks, a little selling to bring down a price quite significantly. The temptation, I think, to create a little liquidity, a little bit of a reserve, probably makes sense.
Mm-hmm. And what have you been selling? What stocks?
Well, I sold my James Fisher shipping company, which I bought, I think, in around 2000. I paid, I think I'm right in saying about 78p for those shares. And at that stage, it was just a small fleet of coastal tankers operating from Barrow in Furness. And over the years, it's developed, of course, into a major, very successful marine services business with a big underwater technological aspect to it. And so I was able to sell the shares, I think I'm right in saying, at about £18.
Wow.
But you know, that is having held them for 18 years, so one's got to put that in perspective. And similarly, I sold another tranche of Gooch & Housegoe, which is an electro-optical laser firm that I also bought in the early 2000s for just over £1. And I think I was selling those for, I think, getting on for £17. Mm-hmm. So, you know, both companies that I've held over the years, they've you know, had their ups and downs. We've been through periods of considerable volatility and uncertainty. But, you know, by and large, I'm a strong believer in staying with companies, particularly if you believe you're in a good company, and not chopping and changing. And chopping and changing, in my view, is the biggest mistake that most private investors make.
Because of the charges as well?
Because of the charges. And, of course, one of the problems in this day and age is because one can obtain prices so instantaneously, with the way technology works now and the development of the internet and apps and similar, the temptation to take a profit, I think, is actually greater than it was historically. Mm-hmm. And I believe you should resist. So my belief is, and there is this old American adage, quote, you know, you make your money by sitting on your ass. You get into something good and stay with it. And certainly that philosophy has paid off for me.
And so have you been buying anything?
The one or two that I've added to very recently, I added to Dejan, which is I described as a slightly quirky property company, very conservative, very low level of borrowings, big holdings of residential property in London, lots of blocks of flats in North London, and valuable commercial property, both in this country and the US. And there is a huge discount here on as between share price and asset value. The asset value last declared was about £111 a share, and the shares are just less than £60. There's a massive discount. So I think they're a very solid value for the long term. And then I also added to a company called Titan, who are in ventilation products, with a very profitable joint venture in South Korea that I think is the market leader there. And that's a conservative managed business, cash rich, moving the dividend forward, profits are moving forward nicely, and modestly rated. So I just topped up a little there. But I tend to prefer to add to existing holdings and build them up to of significant size rather than to broad or larger portfolio.
And finally, I know our listeners will want me to ask this question. So going forward, will you still be a buy and hold investor, or will you change your strategy?
No, absolutely no intention of changing. I think I'm a little too old to change. It's a policy that served me well. And when you look today, I was reading in the paper that ASOS, for example, which came out at you could invest in 2001 when they went public on AIM at 20p, and the shares today are over £50. Mm-hmm. It just shows what can be done if you get into the right stock and hold it.
Good advice. That was Lord Lee. You can read his column if you go to the personal finance section on ft.com. And before we go, we want to know who you trust to help you manage your money. And we're asking readers to complete a short anonymous online survey. Go to www.ft.com/niceadvice and you'll be entered into a prize draw to win a subscription to ft.com. The Money Show will be back next Thursday at 6 a.m. Goodbye.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.